care. And they spend so much time and energy defending that wall. They show up at the zoning board meetings, and they yell at the aldermen, and they gum up the process. And those of us seeking a different kind of community, a more open and inclusive community, we got to start showing up at those zoning board meetings too. And we got to stand from our seats, and we have to tell our elected officials, like, look, I am not going to underwrite this community's longstanding tradition of segregation. I am not going to deny those kids opportunities my kids get living here. Build it. So that's the proposal. You lift the floor by rebalancing the safety net. You empower the poor by reining in exploitation. And you turn your back on segregation and opportunity hoarding, and you embrace broad prosperity. This is how we can end poverty in America. I think it's frankly hard to put into words what this would mean for millions of kids and parents and grandparents below the poverty line. This would mean a whole different existence. This would mean a life marked by more fairness and safety and security. This is a full incorporation, finally, of the poor into the union, to the benefit of the union. I mean, think of all the nurses and diplomats and poets and scientists that poverty has stolen from us, reducing people born for better things. The end of poverty will require new policies. It will require new movements, for sure. But it will also require that each one of us become poverty abolitionists. Like abolitionist movements against slavery or against the prison, poverty abolitionism views its enemy as an abomination. And like other abolitionist movements, this one holds fast to the conviction that profiting from someone else's pain corrupts all of us. This is a personal and political project. Those who seek it out divests from poverty in our consumption choices, in our investment decisions. We support governments actively trying to end poverty by rebalancing the safety net through fair tax implementation. We detest all forms of exploitation, even if, maybe especially if, we benefit from them. And we reject scarcity, and we reject segregation, and we stand for broad prosperity. I want to end poverty in America. I want to end it. Why settle for anything less? Like, why accept the boring, pernicious, best-we-can-do-ism that has gripped the American imagination in recent years? When the Johnson administration launched the war on poverty in 1964, they set a deadline. They set a deadline for the end of poverty. For realsies, we once had ambitions to eradicate scarcity from this land, and I hope we can rekindle those ambitions today. And for those of you in the audience that are eager to connect with the anti-poverty movement, either at the national level or here in Seattle in your own backyards, I have a website for you. It's just called In Poverty USA. It does two simple things. It's designed to connecting families to social services they could really use, and it's designed to connect all of us to organizations putting in the work fighting poverty here in Washington and elsewhere. So if you want to get plugged in with your time and resources, if you just want to know what people are fighting for here, check it out. If you're homeless or unemployed, or if you're on a fixed income, if you've been like evicted, excluded, stepped on, exploited, this is your fight. If you're one of those millions of Americans floating in that space between poverty and security, like cutting coupons, dreading the bills coming, this is your fight. If you're a young person just fed up with impossibly expensive cities and $75,000 college degrees, but also like fed up with all our polite excuses for how things have to be the way they are, this is your fight. And if you found prosperity, some security, if you wish the same for your neighbor, if all this deprivation and hunger and harm around you offends your sense of decency and morality, I think this is your fight too. I think we have to ask of ourselves and our communities, our faith institutions, our businesses, our schools, what are we doing to divest from poverty? Because the end of poverty is something to stand for, to fight for, to sacrifice for. All this poverty in our midst belies any claim to our greatness. The people of the richest nation in the world can and should put an end to it. We don't need to outsmart this problem. We just need to hate it more. Thank you for your time. I really look forward to the conversation.
You talk a lot about the why, right? Why, I mean, that's the book, right? Poverty by a specific space.
Yeah.
And you end by getting to this notion of how do we become abolitionists? How do we do this? And
yeah.
So I'd love to just start there.
Yeah.
Start with some inspiration. We'll head into some meat, and then maybe we'll end with a little inspiration.
Yeah, no,
too.
I love that question. Here's five tangible things you can do right now. One, we all got some influence somewhere, right? I'm a university professor. I should be asking my university, how we treat our landscapers, guys. You know, we taking care of our first-generation college students. You know, I've got a bit of influence. We all have a bit of influence somewhere. Flex it. Second, we can shop and invest differently. A lot of us are like, here's my organic cucumber that was grown on this farm down the road. Now, I'm married to an organic farmer. I appreciate the organic cucumber, but we often do not know how much the farm hand got paid picking that cucumber. You know, we can consult groups like Union Plus or B Corps when we're choosing to spend our money. Those of us that have retirement accounts, savings accounts, a lot of us were like, we're divesting from Exxon. I don't want to put my money in dirty fuels. Are we asking that question about corporations that are screwing over their workers? We want to invest in those too? So I think we can invest and shop differently. Third, we can talk about our taxes differently, maybe even respond to tax time differently come April. A lot of time come April, this is how all of us talk about taxes. Taxes. And, taxes should hurt, Reagan famously said, and they do hurt in America. But that blinds us to the fact that how many accrue to the top 20% of Americans, especially white Americans. If you look at the data, like 84% of the mortgage interest deduction, top 20% of Americans. 95% of capital gains deduction, top 20%. Even pensions and retirement funds, 64%, top 20% of Americans. So a big part of the tax code is set apart for like literally white wealth fare. And a lot of time, like progressive folks that have some means often say, you know, the government should tax us more. But since they don't, you know, I guess it makes sense to take this deduction. But we could start taxing ourselves more, like now, by a coordinated campaign about those deductions. So I'm a homeowner now. For years, I've spoken out against the mortgage interest deduction, which is ridiculous and regressive, and there's zero evidence that it increases homeownership. I don't think people like me should receive this benefit. So our family calculates it every year and gives it away to like local affordable housing, and we write our congressperson saying, I do not want this. Please take this away from me. If you guys have this year, why don't you join me? And then when your neighbor says, taxes, you can be like, I know, dude, check out my crib. I get a government benefit for this. And there's a million public school kids that are homeless. That's absurd. And so I gave this away to my local eviction defense, and I wrote my congressperson saying, you should take it away. That's an awkward conversation. But like that's how we change the common sense in America. I've got two more. You asked a big question.
Yeah.
Go to the zoning board meetings and join the anti-poverty movement. So I think like no matter, like some of us are like, yeah, I'm there, I'm gonna join the movement. Some of us are down to spend our money a little differently. I think we can all plug in.
Thank you for that. How do we get more first adopters, right?
You can act. And I think in your action, you can help spread this. So I know that some of you might be like, well, this is a drop in the bucket. But as the philosopher G.A. Cohen wrote in his perfectly titled essay, if you're an egalitarian, why are you so rich? You're already dropping a smaller drop in the bucket. Why don't you drop a little bigger drop in the bucket? And those drops matter. You know, we see this with climate change. You know, you drive down the street and you're like, did Cheryl get solar panels? Cheryl got solar panels. And then you might really care about climate change, but you don't push that button for solar panels until Cheryl gets it. And then someone sees your solar panels and on it goes. We got this great policy from the Biden administration, right? The Inflation Reduction Act, the biggest thing that Congress has done for climate. I do not think it would be possible for us to get that giant structural change if many of us were like, what you eating, Daniel? What you eating, bro? What you driving, bro? You need to take that flight, bro? And so I think that those kind of things can add up to build political will. So I think starting little, you know, and spreading and, you know, talking about that matters. In London, when you walk down the streets, the stores have like this sticker on the door. It says, this store pays a living wage. You know? Our store's got a lot of stickers, but often it's not that one. And I'd love us to be like, you know, oh, those are cute shoes. Where'd you get those shoes? Be like, I found this amazing fair wage shoe department. Like, I have done this. It's called Simon and Beckett. I order dress shoes from them. It takes forever. But like, when you get the shoes, they're beautiful, and you get a note from the person that made them. They're like, thank you. This company pays me a living wage. So now I get to have a different conversation about my shoes. And so I think like those kind of things can build up something. So I think that a lot of us are like, how do we do this though? And we're often like, yeah, how do we do this for like those guys? And I'm often like, why don't we start with us guys? And then we'll see, yeah.
Thank you. We as a nation seem to struggle in these dualities, right? That we have capitalism and government subsidies, that we live in a state of historic slavery, but then talk about freedom or currently have worker exploitation. And so I'm wondering, you know, as what you just, you know, just discussed right there, and we think about the notion of low road capitalism, how do we translate that into something that is more morally sound?
I think the younger generation is totally interested in a different kind of conversation. They're like, why do we need capitalism at all? And I think what they're saying is, this is not working for us. This is different. When I went on the road for Evicted, no one was really having like the capitalism conversation. And every single talk now I give, someone like in their 20s will stand up and be like, capitalism. And so I think that's a signal for us that there's a growing discontent among younger folks. Harnessing that discontent is really important. There's a growing discontent across party lines on this. You know, most Democrats and most Republicans, according to poll data, think that the minimum wage is too low. Most Democrats and most Republicans think that the rich aren't paying their fair share of taxes. They're right, you know? Most Republicans and most Democrats think that poverty is a structural failing, not an individual failing. So like these old narratives are shifting and dying. They're getting stale and weak. And so I think that one thing that we can do to get to another place is to start changing this story. But the other thing we can do is start taking moral action now. Like, why are we always waiting around for Congress to get their act together? Haven't we learned that we need to act? And like a big lesson from the 60s, right, is like Congress is a mess. The Dixiecrats are aligned with the Republicans blocking reform. Senators are sleeping in their offices to filibuster.
Sounds a little familiar.
Yeah, right? And like we get major pieces of civil rights legislation, and then we got the war on poverty and the Great Society. And we got it because the labor movement and the civil rights movement put unrelenting pressure on policymakers. And I'm just so glad that they weren't like, well, we'll wait for the next election. Fall on our side next time, you know? So I think we could start acting now.
What is the role of kind of the, not at the federal level, but maybe not at the town hall meeting level in terms of what, I think what this speaks here is like what we're seeing with housing authorities, what we're seeing with nonprofit or service programs like AmeriCorps. What role do they serve in this effort?
They play this enormous role, right? I mean, the nonprofit sector is our fourth biggest sector of the economy. And often nonprofits are the thing that's standing between a family and homelessness or a family and hunger. So they play a huge role. I would, for the philanthropists and founders or funders in the room tonight, I'd love to see more money going into direct action, you know, anti-poverty movements that are really working on empowering the poor in a specific way. I'd like to see more money flowing into new thinking about how to spur on the new labor movement or the new housing movement. And I think this is a space that philanthropy and funders have been a little hesitant to get into, but it's a space that I find very exciting and productive. This is also a space where funders and philanthropy can play a role in narrative change. This takes, like, it takes a lot more resources to tell a fire story than to tell a jumper story. So tomorrow I could wake up, I could go down to eviction court, I could meet a family getting evicted, I could write about that family. And that's what we usually get in the press, right? Like with the housing crisis or other issues like this. Like, check out this family getting evicted, it's really sad. And it is sad. But like, to understand like who owns Seattle, like who's doing all the evictions, what is the tie between Seattle City Council and like landlord interests? You know, those kind of questions are harder. And I think those kind of require kind of different and deeper kind of investments. So I'd like to see more investments in that way.
In, I think it was 2020, you stopped going to Home Depot and you started going to your local hardware store. But one of the things you reference in that is, I don't ask the question of, do you pay fair wages? You know, what are your labor practices? Yeah. And so, you know, it's sometimes easy to identify who the bad actors are. I think you named a few, you know, throughout the talk today. Yeah. But how do we know who those, you know, if there isn't a sticker on the window that we can easily identify, how do we do that self-reflection or that action to determine where we spend with our wallets?
I write about us going to Ace Hardware, and the other day I got an email from the CEO of Ace Hardware. He's like, we pay our workers for extra foot. You know, I was like, okay. This is homework. We got to do our homework. And so I like consulting this organization called Union Plus. And it just like, so you got to mail a package. Like UPS is unionized, FedEx isn't. So why don't you just mail it with UPS? Like if you're a university, why don't you contract with UPS? You know, if you want a drink, like Snapple is union made. If you want a beer, Miller's union made. And so like Union Plus curates this list of union made products and you can kind of figure it out. B Corp is another great organization that you can kind of consult, you know, that ranks companies and gives them like high ratings if they treat the workers well and treat the environment well. These are small companies and large companies. So you can go to B Corp, you can go to Union Plus and curate it. Oftentimes we think of like, oh, it's the Walmarts and stuff, but like, what's your florist paying its workers? You know, like we could just straight ask and we can kind of send this signal to organizations that we value, that we support. Like, this really matters to me and I'm going to shop here because of this, you know, and if you don't do this, I'm going to stop shopping here because of this. And so I think it just takes a bit of homework. We've done this with other stuff. We have apps about like what kind of fish to order, right, at the restaurant, which is great. But like, can we get some more kind of attention and data and information about this kind of work? Yeah.
Yeah. In the back, we were talking.
Slow down. We can slow down. So like the shoes I talked about before, yeah, they took like a month or two to get to me, which is like a million years in American time. But like when we lean into, and like I'm not like a consumption hero. Like, I do these things too. When we leaned into quick and convenient apps, you know, someone often pays the price for that. So just a little slowness, a little check, a little pause, I think matters for this too.
In this region, we love to learn, we love to hear, we love to talk with people about things, and we're not the best at kind of taking that further from there, right? And often we stay in our walled neighborhoods, we stay in our walled environments, And so just wondering, kind of, if you can speak a little bit more of how do we as a society actually become in community and be in relationship with those who are living in poverty?
Yeah, I don't think it's hard if you try. It's like the old journalist phrase, like showing up is 90% of it. So I think that if we're really striving to be in real community with folks, including folks below the poverty line, not relationships of charity, like relationships where like you call their BS, they call your BS, you know their kids' names, they know yours, that kind of relationship. I don't think that that's hard. There are studies showing that the places where class, kind of people from different classes commingle the most, do you know where it is? Applebee's. You know, Applebee's. But there's ride the bus, don't look at your phone, strike up a conversation, you know, go in communities. And I want to say two things about this. One thing I want to say is like, when you do that, you are holding yourselves accountable in a very personal way. to folks that are struggling. And that for my line of work, this is like a requirement. So one of the first book talks I gave was in Princeton, where I teach, big Presbyterian church, and I gave a talk, and the first comment, this person stood up and was like, I volunteer in the poor neighborhood. And we give a lot of tutoring to kids, but shouldn't we be tutoring and mentoring these single moms? And she sat down. Question. And so I look out in the audience, and there's my friend Vanessa, who's a single mom in Trenton. You know, and I was like, there's no way I'm answering this question that doesn't hold me accountable to Vanessa. So I was like, that's not the conversation we're having. You know, we need to have a new conversation. And so I think that really matters. The second thing about this is like, how does your affluence feel? You feel safe? You feel connected? You know, like, and I think that I don't want to romanticize poverty, and I don't. But like, I've lived in very poor neighborhoods and in affluent neighborhoods, and I've never experienced the kind of neighborliness and generosity that I've experienced in poor neighborhoods. And there's a lot of us that are experiencing a spiritual poverty in America because we've settled for this lonely, stingy affluence. And I think an opening up of communities is not going to be easy for some of us. Let's not sugarcoat it. What we get from this bargain, from this difficult sacrifice, is like just a better community too, a more vibrant, open, fluid community. And I think a lot of us are down for that bargain, even if it might sting a bit.
As wealth has created these enclaves where we start eroding some of the public spaces and then even more so don't want to engage with them. So I don't know if there's more you want to speak to that, but.
Yeah, this is this dynamic called private opulence and public squalor. This is an old term, goes back to but I really caught it in John Kenneth Galbraith's famous book, The Affluent Society. And it's this thing that happens when a lot of rich people live alongside a lot of poor people in the same country. And so what happens is that the rich people divest from things that are public. They stop taking the bus, they got a car. They stop swimming in the community pool, they can dig their own pool. They stop sending their kids to parks, they can get a country club. On and on it goes. And pretty soon, what happens is that dynamic increases, that things that are public get increasingly, and then sometimes exclusively used only by the poor, and they become disinvested, run down, shabby, and pretty soon everyone hates them, and things are blamed to be bad because they're public, not because we've taken money away from them. And then that makes things worse for all of us. So instead of investing in high-speed trains, we got stuck in traffic in our nice cars. You know, instead of investing in nice, beautiful parks, you know, we have to kind of drive 45 minutes. And so I think that you see kind of public squalor and private opulence like an extreme, like in cities in the developed world, like Lagos in Nigeria, big, beautiful mansions surrounded by barbed wire, private security firms. When I see that often, it looks kind of like us a bit, you know, trending in that direction. And I think part of this kind of story is like, gee, wouldn't it be nice for parents not to have that pit in our stomachs all the time about our kids? Like, are they going to fall all the way down? Wouldn't it be nice dinner and not worry, like, are they treating their restaurant workers okay? I think a lot of us want to divest from this kind of morally compromised relationships we find ourselves in.
So I promised we'd start with some inspiration and end with some inspiration. And one of the pieces in the book that really moved me was how you describe a day in the life of America once we've ended poverty. And so I'm wondering if you can share that as some inspiration for folks here of what does America look like then? How does it feel?
So the end of poverty doesn't mean a utopia. It's not the only problem we have. It doesn't mean equality. It doesn't mean you have to give up your Tesla or Disney World. It does mean being able to walk down the street and feel a lot safer. It does mean not having to worry about your kid falling into real hard times. It means getting on the bus and not seeing all those exhausting faces of the working poor. You wouldn't be one of those faces. You could go out to eat or spend the night in a hotel and rest assured that people are held and taken care of. Oscar Wilde said the best thing about socialism is that you don't have to care about anyone anymore. because, you know, we're all kind of okay. That doesn't mean we're equal and there's every problem settled, but a lot of the problems that we care about, a lot of the problems that really keep us up at night, the taproot reaches back to poverty. So I think that the end of poverty, it's more vibrant. Democracy's more vibrant. You get a country that's a lot more dynamic because all this talent and opportunity isn't being denied people. So I don't know. When I hear that, I just feel like, yeah, I'm willing to give something to get that. And I hope, you know, I hope you are too.
Thank you. And with that,
thank you so much.
You were just listening to Matthew Desmond, Ending Poverty in America. He spoke in Seattle's town hall in late March 2024. The moderator was Danielle Zavala. Matthew Desmond is a professor of sociology at Princeton University. His latest book is Poverty by America. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Matthew Desmond, Ending Poverty in America, and for his book, Poverty by America, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Seattle Arts and Letters. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. For farm workers, toiling outside in the summer heat can be dangerous. Extreme heat can lead to headaches, dizziness, and even death. And as the climate warms, the risks will grow.
We all know that record-breaking temperatures are now becoming much more common.
Judge Laura Safer Espinoza helps run the Fair Food Program, partnership between workers, growers, and more than a dozen large food buyers. The program protects thousands of workers on participating farms from workplace hazards while defending their wages and rights. A few years ago, it added protections against heat stress. From April to November, farm workers now have to take breaks every 2 hours. Espinoza says the mandate prevents people from feeling pressure to keep working even when they need to cool down.
This requires everyone across the field to stop and to rest, to hydrate.
Supervisors also have to watch for any workers who show signs of heat illness and provide them with immediate relief. As the risk of extreme heat grows, these heat stress protections will help keep the workers who are covered by the Fair Food Program safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.